This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. I'm initiating the oral history interview with Dr. I. Thomas Shepherd. Today's date is the 3rd of October, 2005. I am in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, and Dr. Shepherd is joining me by telephone from Washington State. And Tom, first of all, thank you for your time. I appreciate your willingness to participate in the Oral History Project. I want to welcome you to the project, and just for clarification purposes, ascertain whether we have your permission to make this interview available to researchers who may come to the Vietnam Archive in the future looking for information on the things that you encountered in your career.
Yes, you do.
Thanks, Tom. First of all, if you wouldn't mind, Tom, could we start with some basic biographical data? Could you tell me where you were born, when, and maybe a little bit about where you grew up?
Sure. I was born August 26, 1930, in a hospital in Orange, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
After the birth, my folks took me back home to a town called Kearney, named after General Philip Kearney, and I lived there until I was 17 years old. I went through kindergarten and grade school and junior high school and Kearney High School with the same classmates for the entire 12 years. It was a wonderful, just a wonderful thing that doesn't happen very often these days.
Yeah.
So it was a very secure, very wonderful place. And in the summers, we went to Ocean Gate, New Jersey, which is down on Barney Gat Bay. And I could swim before I remember being able to swim. I grew up sailing a 16-foot sailboat. We were there all summer and then back home for the regular school year and so on until I was 17.
What did your dad do? What did your mom do? Did she work outside the home?
No. You must remember, we're talking the 30s now.
Mm-hmm.
And early 40s, and my mother was what we term a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was an electrician, and he worked for a number of years with a company called Congolian Naren, which made hard surface floor coverings, and it's still in existence today. It's known as Congolian today. So it was a very typical working class background, and it was a secure and safe and good feeling as you could ever imagine.
It sounds quite idyllic, actually. Not really what most people would picture the late 1930s feeling like.
Mm-hmm.
to a young person.
Right. I learned later, of course, that my dad was greatly affected by the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
and when I was very, very young, he had actually spent a number of years without a formal job, and things were difficult, but at 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 years of age, you're really not aware of that. At least I wasn't. It was just, I had mom and dad, and I had an older brother,
mm-hmm.
who was 12 years older than I was, so in many respects, later on in life, it was almost like having two dads, because there's tremendous split in 12 years. And my brother went into the Army during the Second World War, and I was too young to go into the Army. I was still in junior high school and then high school.
Where did your brother serve? What was his name, first of all?
Elwood.
Mm-hmm.
And he hated that name with a passion.
Mm-hmm.
Shepherd, and he was in primarily the 4th Armored Division of Patton's 3rd Army, and it was one of his proudest things to say that he served with Patton. He just simply loved the guy. So I heard some wonderful stories about the Army at that time, and I always thought that it was one of the good things that my brother had done was to serve so wonderfully and go in, and I think it was the 3rd day after D-Day, and fight all through Europe in the 4th Armored Division.
And did he
see? He rose to the rank of Master Sergeant.
Uh-huh.
And our personalities are completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, he felt understand that from the standpoint, I thought if you were in an organization, you wanted to lead it. And I knew that you had to be a general to lead the organization. But he was not interested in leaving the fellows that he had started with in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
You remember there are supposedly three needs that people have. One is for power, one is for affiliation, and the other is achievement. And I think my drive was achievement, and I think his drive was affiliation. And that, I think, for me, explains part of it.
Did he enlist with a whole group of guys who were able to pretty much stay together then?
I would say that the people from our hometown, Kearney and so forth, when they all went in, they stayed together through Camp Kilmer, which was in New Jersey, and then Fort Dix, which was in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, they did get spread around, and I don't think there was the idea that they were all from their hometown together, no.
But his identification then with the men in his unit in Europe,
right,
was a strong one?
Right. Well, he spent a year in the States in training and so on.
Right. Yes.
And then the unit went overseas as a whole. And so he had been with these people then for 3 years. And, you know, you can get very, very close very, very quickly when someone is shooting at you.
And so I'm going to assume that he came back well from
yes.
the war. And
when the war was over, he came home and went to work in the same or company that my dad was working in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say totally different from me. He went to work there where my dad was, and he stayed there for most of his adult life.
And has he passed away?
Yes, he did.
Okay. How long did he live?
He was just touching 80 when he died.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever have a chance to get together with those guys from his unit in later days?
There were a few of them that he stayed in touch with for the entire time, right up until his death or their death. I know that two or three of them lived in Pennsylvania, and I don't remember where the others were, but they indeed stayed very tight. They would visit each other and spend a weekend or two every year or so.
That's really interesting. This is sort of before the era, really, of veterans organizations or unit associations, that those ties stayed
mm-hmm.
strong for him.
Right, and it was before the era of the Internet.
Yes.
It wasn't an easy thing to stay in touch. You had to make an effort to stay in touch.
But it sounds like his experience and his stories were important for you.
Yes, indeed.
In thinking about what you might
they
do.
They were. I grew up listening to his stories and watching John Wayne in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And that really set the tone for me that said the military is good, patriotism is good, flag and country are things we should revere. Indeed, that was the general feeling that I had.
Did your parents have plans for you post high school, or were they going to let you kind of sort that out on your own?
They were not. In those days, even to go to Rutgers University in New Jersey would have been a financial burden that they just could not have
yes.
handled.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, they were not as savvy in terms of finding scholarships. I'm sure there were scholarships, but that was not in their realm.
Mm-hmm.
They had no idea about that kind of thing. And somehow it came from me. I had learned about the Coast Guard Academy, and when I was a youngster, I joined an organization called, wasn't the Sea Scouts, it was the Naval Cadets. And the Naval Cadets had a small, I would say ship, but that's a little too much. They had a boat that had been donated to them by the Navy from the leftovers of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And you wore a sailor's uniform with a little shield on it that said Naval Cadet. And finishing the bright work.
Sure.
So I had that little experience, and I had heard about the Coast Guard Academy, and I thought, that is the thing that I want to do. And you didn't have to have political connections. You didn't have to have a congressional appointment as you do to go to West Point or any of the other service academies. You simply had to take the general test, pass it high enough so that you were above the cutoff,
mm-hmm.
pass the physical, and then you would be entered. And if I remember correctly, that year, the year before, something like 400 gentlemen had been taken into the fourth class, and 8,000 had taken the test. So the odds were not good, but I was very confident.
And it's one of the gifts of youth.
I was doing well in high school. Uh-huh. When I went to high school, the coaches of the athletic team said, "Hot dog, here comes another Shepherd," because my brother had played football, he played soccer, he did all of those things. And the teachers said, "Uh-oh, here comes another Shepherd." Well, it turned out to be just the opposite. The teachers said, "Oh, this is really different." And the coaches said, "Oh, he's not interested like his brother was." And I wasn't. For some reason, I found the academics more exhilarating than playing football.
Did you try it? Did you go out for the team?
Yes, I went out for football.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, I was dating a lovely young lady from Maplewood, New Jersey, which is one of the upscale towns in the place.
Mm-hmm.
And about the first two or three days out, we were working in the scrub uniforms. In other words, the hand-me-downs from the varsity.
Right.
And we're trying out to be on the varsity and so on. And in those days, there were no face protectors at all. Your face stuck out. So very shortly after, I had a skinned nose and a sort of a split lip, and I'm trying to date this lovely young lady from Maplewood,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking, does she want a football hero, or does she want someone who can afford to take her out? And I thought, maybe I better get a part-time job and not play football. And as it happened, in those days, a couple of the people that I tried out with and worked with, one of them, named Alex Webster, ended playing for the New York Giants, a professional team. And
is that right?
And I remember Alex Webster, when we were both sophomores in high school, walking up and down on the goal line looking for the two front teeth that had just been knocked out of his mouth. And I thought, gee, he's 15 like I am, and his two front teeth are split now. That's not a good thing.
Mm.
And so I got a part-time job so I could afford to date the young lady. And
keep your teeth.
Right. Alex Webster became a football hero who had two false teeth when he was very young.
What year did you graduate from high school?
January 1948. We had, in our town, back earlier, there had been a classroom crunch or some kind of a crunch, and so they started having, I was skipped a half a grade so that I could be in the January class in grade school instead of the June class. You know what I mean? They actually
mm-hmm.
split the grades so that when I went to high school, I graduated in January 1948, and there was another graduation for another section in the normal June of 1948. So I got out in January 48, and I was ready to take the Coast Guard Academy test. And the day before the test, I was stricken with appendicitis, rushed to West Hudson Memorial Hospital, and in those days, they kept you in the hospital for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So I had my appendix out the day before the test, and on the day of the test, I was in the bed, in the hospital, recovering. And so I didn't get a chance to take the test. I was heartbroken. It felt as if they had pulled the legs right out from under me, and I wondered, what am I going to do now? And in came a classmate from high school, Charles Rupp. Wonderful guy, bright guy, and he came in and said, "How are you feeling? How are you doing? And then he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. The Coast Guard Academy won't have another exam for another year. And he told me, he said, well, I'm going to the New York State Maritime Academy, and I will be a cadet midshipman, United States Naval Reserve, and I will go through 4 years and get my degree, and I will be an ensign in the Navy. And I said, that's wonderful. How did you do that? And he told me, well, New York State runs this academy. It's part of the State University of New York,
mm-hmm.
and you have to take a test, and then you have to go before a board, and if you're accepted, you can go. So I thought, wow, when is the cutoff date? And he said, it's in March for the September class. So I knew I had time. So as soon as I got out of the hospital, I did all of the paperwork and everything for the preliminaries, and they said, gee, this is really great, except we don't have room for any more out-of-state cadets. If you were a New York State cadet, we could do something. Well, my dad had friends who lived in Tarrytown, New York, and suddenly I moved to Tarrytown, New York.
Beautiful.
With this address, I was able to take the test. I passed the test. Then I was called in for the board, and I will never forget that the president of the board was named Captain Blood. I couldn't forget that. Captain Blood.
That's almost too perfect.
It's almost as if he were out of the right. movies with Earl Flynn, but
right.
he was Captain Blood. I met the board, I answered their questions, and a few weeks later, I got a fat envelope, not a skinny envelope, and it said, congratulations, you are now a cadet midshipman, United States Naval Reserve, you are draft exempt, and you will go into the four-year college program at the New York State Maritime Academy, and the next year they changed the name to the New York State Maritime College of the State of New York, you know, SUNY Maritime College.
And where is it exactly?
It's in Throgs Neck. What a beautiful name.
Yes.
Throgs Neck, which is a tiny peninsula in the end of the Bronx with the East River on one side and the Hudson River, I think, on the other side. Something's on the other side. And the fort had been built during the Civil War, as I remember. It's a huge stone block edifice in the shape of a pentagon. And so...
Guarding the...
Starting in September. Mm-hmm. No, actually, we went in August as sort of the underclassmen were called mugs. And mm-hmm. so mugs went in a month early to get acclimated to the nautical life and learn all of the nomenclature and start memorizing all of the rules that fourth classmen had to carry out in order to be successful. And so I was lucky, and I got a position and went to the academy, and my friend Charlie Rupp, who lived in the same hometown, and I went over the first day together, which was very helpful to go in.
I was going to ask whether he did similarly well.
Well,
sounds like he did.
I'll just tell you if that's part of the program.
Sure.
We started off, and for the first 6 months, life is hell. You couldn't wear a ring. You had to carry matches in case the upper class wanted a light. You had to carry a knife, one of these small nautical pen knives we had to carry. We had to make square corners where anytime we went from A to B, if we couldn't make a straight line, we had to make a square corner. We had to sit on the first 3 inches of our chairs in the mess hall. We had to eat square meals where the fork comes straight up and then straight back and then straight forward and then straight down. It was the typical plebe kind of a routine. And we were there without a break from August until the Thanksgiving weekend. And if we didn't have demerits, we were allowed to go for 3 days on Thanksgiving. And so we went home, Charlie Rupp and I, and we were all decked out in our midshipman's uniforms, and we felt like $1 million, and we had a wonderful time, and we visited each other's families, and we just had a terrific time. And then we came back to the academy, and the grind started again. And if you had 100 demerits, you were flunked out of the school. And the upper class gave out the demerits.
Ooh.
So you had to be, I learned something called silent contempt, which occasionally I got a few demerits for. And it's where your demeanor tells the upperclassman that you are contemptuous of him. And it doesn't take a word. It doesn't take a gesture.
Mm-hmm.
It just takes demeanor. So I was learning to work on a demeanor that did not evince silent contempt for some of the upperclassmen whom I thought were contemptible. And I was learning that. And so was Charlie. He was having a more difficult time than I was. And in those days, we all smoked, but you weren't allowed to smoke for your first year at the academy. Now, you can imagine how many smokes were sneaked somewhere. And if you were caught, you got demerits. Some of the kids foolishly, on a weekend, got a tattoo. That was 25 demerits because gentlemen did not have tattoos and so forth. So it was pretty rough. While we were studying for our grades, we were also being hazed, sometimes at the whim of one of the really nasty guys. One was named Lash Dubon. Lash Dubon, that was his nickname. If he really had a bad night, occasionally he would get us out of bed in our rooms. We slept in double bunks. And we would have to sit on top of our lockers and row to China, which meant you imitated the rowing motion sitting up in the air on a locker at 2 o'clock in the morning when you were supposed to be sleeping. After a half an hour of that, why, Lash Dubon would say, all right, that's enough, get back in bed, and then he would leave. No explanation. It was just harassment. And at the same time, we were expected to keep up our grades. So it was really a difficult time. And when the Christmas break came, Charlie Rupp and I went back home, and we had a wonderful Christmas. We had something like 10 days off. And in that 10 days, a change came over Charlie. He began to realize what he was missing outside. And when the leave was over and we went back, we got off of the bus at the entrance to the fort, and it was a long walk up to a guard gate, and we were having our last cigarette because we weren't allowed to smoke for the first year. And as he took a drag on a cigarette, he flipped it in the air away. He turned and said over his shoulder to me, "Tell him I quit," and he walked away just like that. And I was so stunned, I didn't know what to make out of it. I thought, surely he'll be here in the morning. So I went in, and in the morning he wasn't there, and he sent paperwork over and said he quit. I want to just end this, tie it together. 25 years later, I was a lieutenant colonel on the Joint Strategic Target Planning Staff, and I ran a particular staff looking at Soviet air defense. And we were stationed with SAC at Offutt Air Force Base. And SAC was the Strategic Air Command, which was so famous. And Jimmy Stewart made a movie and so on. We were at SAC headquarters because they had the largest group of Air Force intelligence people. And we were doing these super secret things. And I had been there about a year. And one day, for some reason, I had to leave SAC headquarters and go out to one of the Air Force buildings on Offutt Air Force Base. And I got to the building and walked in, and I walked up to the desk to get some information, and I looked down. I said, "Sergeant, I'm Colonel Shepard. I would like to know where." And the sergeant looked up, and it was Charlie Rupp. And I said, "My God, you're Charlie Rupp." And he looked up, and he he called me Shep. He said, Shep. And I said, holy gee, Charlie. I said, we've got to have a cup of coffee. Where can we go to have a cup of coffee? Well, as you know, there is an organizational distance in the military between
sure.
officers and enlisted. So we worked out that we would meet at the post exchange where they had a little coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the post exchange, and Charlie was totally different from the guy I knew. He was reticent, relatively uncommunicative. He told me that he had married a girl from Iceland, and I said, well, I don't know how we're going to work it, but we've got to get together and have dinner, and it's been so long, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he let me know in a number of ways that that wasn't going to happen. We just weren't going to have any nostalgia or whatever happened to, he just didn't want to do that.
Could you figure out why? Was it?
Yes, I know exactly why.
Uh-huh.
In high school, he and I belonged to the in crowd, the people who were always going and doing and being in the little school papers and so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a driver, and I think his ego just would not let him associate now with someone who hadn't thrown the cigarette away and who was now an officer, a field grade officer, and he was a non-commissioned officer. I just don't think he wanted to deal with that situation. And so
you think it was really due to the discrepancy in your ranks
yeah,
and experiences subsequently?
In the way our lives had turned out, Charlie came from a wealthier part of town, wealthier family, and I did obviously say, well, what happened after New York State Maritime Academy? And he said, oh, I joined the Air Force. And, you know, and here we were 20 years later,
wow.
however long it was. I guess, let's see, that would have been 1950 when he threw that cigarette away, or 51.
Mm-hmm.
And here we were now in 1969 or 70. And I just think he didn't want to handle that. So, anyhow, it was very, very interesting.
Yes.
And he was the reason why I got to go to the academy. It took 2 years in the academy for the academy and I to realize I was not cut out to be a marine engineer.
Was that the only route, Tom? Or what?
Yes.
Okay.
You had to take the calculus no matter. You see, it was strictly driven by the Navy and by the Maritime. So it wasn't a case. For instance, all of my liberal arts classes, I had A's. And all of my science classes, I had D's. I could not pass naval architecture, which depends totally on calculus.
I'm sure you weren't the only one.
No,
I mean,
matter of fact, I wasn't. And they got dumped, you know, almost monthly during the 2 years as things would turn out, why people would leave and leave and leave and leave.
Mm-hmm.
I
believe it.
And naval architecture, calculus, and physics used to bring blood out on my forehead. And I, at that time, had not learned how to study for something that I couldn't grasp.
It didn't come just
It did not come naturally to me. And I didn't learn the secret of going to the professor and say, hi, professor, I love your class. I'm having difficulty. I need your help. I didn't know how to say that. I thought that would show a weakness on my part to have to go to the officers. They were all the classes were taught by officers, and I didn't want to have to go and say, I don't understand what you're saying when you do a quadratic equation.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 2 years, I was carried by those other grades for 2 years, but finally, it just sunk me. I couldn't. And so they said, we're terribly sorry, but you're through. And they shook hands, and I turned around and had that long walk toward the gate that Charlie Rupp had thrown his cigarette away at.
And, I mean, how were you feeling at that point?
I was feeling so low that I had disappointed my parents, who had been so delighted that I was going to that institution and I was going to be an officer, and they were just thrilled because I would have been the first college graduate in the family. And when I got home, I thought, this is going to really be difficult, and all I found was sympathy and compassion, and I never, ever heard a single word about why didn't you or what if. I never, ever heard that, and I thought, this is absolutely just marvelous. I'm home.
Wow, how lucky.
Yeah, well, I'll say.
That's,
and
wow.
I started, I've got to find a way to generate the money to get into another college. And, of course, the college that came to mind was Rutgers.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Rutgers would be the place. It's in New Jersey and so forth. But in the meantime, it was May of the year, and I thought, well, I'll get this underway pretty soon, but right now I think I'd better just relax a little. So I went to Seaside, New Jersey, Seaside Park. My family had a summer home over in Ocean Gate, which is on the other side of Barnegat Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Seaside Park, and I applied for a job as a lifeguard. I figured that's the most wonderful thing you can do to change the feeling of being in the military and flunking out. You got to just have some fun. So I took the lifeguard exam, and I ended up on Mathis Beach in Seaside Park, and I started in June. You had to swim out. You had to swim through the surf, and you carried a diamond can, which is a metal can shaped like a diamond that you hand to people who are drowning. And then I had to swim out again with a torpedo can, which was a faster can. And the fastest of the two guards would swim the torpedo, and the stronger or the slower would swim the diamond. The torpedo would get out, hand the torpedo to the drowning person. The diamond would come out, and it was tied onto a long rope that went back to the beach. And then you would change the diamond for the torpedo, and the other guard would swim back in to supervise the hauling on the line to get the drowning person and the lifeguard back in.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, boy, this will be exciting. So I got the job, and we were paid $35 a week, and we were on the beach from 8 a.m. Actually, we were on at 8, but you weren't paid. It didn't start until 9, but you went there to get ready and
mm-hmm.
clean the beach and so forth. So I'd be on the beach from 8 in the morning until 6 at night, 6 days a week for $35, and I loved it. It was one of the best jobs I ever had.
You were what, 20 or so?
I had just turned 20.
20.
Right. And,
yeah, I'll bet that worked pretty well.
It worked very well.
Uh-huh.
The only fly in the ointment in the first month was I got a letter, and the letter was from the government, and the letter said that my friends and neighbors had said it would be okay to draft me, and I thought, holy gee, maybe I better get back in college as quick as I can, because maybe they won't draft guys in college. But in the meantime, here I am on the beach. I'll worry about that in another month or two. So I had my draft notice, and I had the job. And one day, we were sitting on the lifeguard stand, my partner and I, and he was going to the University of Pennsylvania on a swimming scholarship. And between us, we had a big black 30-pound radio called a Zenith Transoceanic. It had a battery that was as big as your forearm.
Cool.
Yeah, and it was called Transoceanic because you could actually raise the antenna and get a lot of stations.
You could get shortwave? You could.
Yes, you could get shortwave mm-hmm. by flipping one of the dials
sure.
over.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sitting listening to music and watching the people on the beach, and they said, we interrupt this program with an announcement. The North Koreans have just invaded South Korea. And my partner on the stand said, where the hell is Korea? Well, shortly, I was to find
out. You were to find out.
I was to find out. The draft board told me that I was going to have to report pretty soon, so I finished the summer as a lifeguard, and I went up to the draft board, and they said, we're not going to call you now. We're going to call you probably 6 or 8 months. And I thought, well, boy, what am I going to do for 6 or 8 months? So I talked to my dad, and he said, well, I can get you a place in the laboratory at Kongolian-Naren for the 6 or 8 months, and at least you can be doing some lab work and not just sitting around wasting your time. So he indeed got me that position, and I was in a lab as a lab assistant, and I did various and sundry little tests on the linoleum and tile that they were running.
Mm-hmm.
And then the draft board sent the notice that said, all right, report to your draft board on this date for your physical. And I did, and they said, okay, we want you. And the thing that I remember most about that experience was there was a room with about 40 or 50 of us sitting in the room. We had taken the physical, which was a very cursory physical. We were sitting in the room with our clothes back on again, waiting for the outcomes, and in came a Marine NCO with another Marine and an Army fellow, and they all had clipboards. And the NCO said something like this, all right, listen up, I don't want any of you to scream, holler, or to faint, but if I call your name, you have been drafted into the Marines. And they called guys on both sides of me, and believe it or not, I was drafted into the Army, and I was thrilled that it was in the Army and not the Marine Corps.
What did you know about the Marine Corps by that stage?
I just knew that that's where the automatons went. Where the people who loved to have it was known as the Catholic Army. In case you didn't know that,
I've heard that. But for someone who doesn't,
it was called the Catholic Army because it had so many Irishmen and so many Latinos in it, and they seemed to like authority more than the norm. That's all I knew. Wayne had played a Marine.
That didn't sound good, though.
No, it did not sound good to this guy who had just come off the summer as a lifeguard.
Mm-hmm.
So I was drafted, and they sent me to Camp Kilmer, which was a camp that had been started in the First World War, I believe, and it was sort of a temporary thing that was still there. And we took a series of tests, and they were called the AGCT tests.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
I am, but for someone who doesn't know anything about those,
it was the Army's version of an IQ test, your intelligence quotient. And you had to have 110. The average score was 100. You had to have 110 to get into officer candidate school. Mine was 123. So I was feeling pretty good. I thought, well, that's okay. And they called me in and said to me, you have a choice. You can go into any of the branches of service you want because of your scores, and you can also go to OCS. And I said, well, what does it cost to go to officer candidate school? What do I pay? I thought maybe I had to spend more time, or I had to buy different uniforms or something. And they said, absolutely no cost, and you don't have to stay in any longer than 18 months, which is the same as you would if you just went to, the Signal Corps. In the meantime, we then had something called the Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, which was not a branch of the Army. It was sort of a stepchild that did tactical intelligence. And the CIC rep came in and said to me, you can go into the intelligence business if you want to. You don't have to go to OCS. And the OCS gentleman said, well, if you really like intelligence, why not go as an officer? Go to OCS and then just go to CIC. So with those things in mind, I thought, well, great, I'll do the OCS routine. So I was sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I was there for 16 weeks of basic training and then advanced basic training. And my question to you, Laura, is do you want to hear anything about basic training?
Actually, I'd love to hear about basic training. What did a day look like? What did the first day look like? And do you remember the first day?
I remember the whole thing quite clearly.
Okay.
I was put into what was called the Scientific and Professional Company.
That sounds good.
Yes. It meant that everybody there was going to go to some kind of specialized training because they had some kind of credentials that the Army thought would be useful. I had 2 years of college, and my AGCT score was 123, so that set me in. One of my bunkmates there was a professional baseball player. Another one was a Princeton graduate. Those are the ones I remember specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went through infantry basic training the first 8 weeks. We were up at about 5:30, and we were out in the quadrangle at 6, and we marched over to the mess hall and then came back, and then we started the training. The first time that I drew the kitchen police, or KP duty, I remember specifically because when I got over there, we were lined up outside, and the master sergeant, who was the head cook, came out and said, all right, we're going to divide you into areas, and some of you will work pots and pans, and we knew that was no good. And he said, some of you are going to work in the grease pit, and we knew that was no good.
Yeah, that sounds bad.
Right. And he said, by the way, are there any college boys here? And my hand shot up, along with a number of others. There must have been, six, eight guys. And he said, good, you guys fall in and get into my office. So we went into the office, and he started assigning tasks because we were college boys. My task was to operate the valves on the huge coffee machine that produced gallons of coffee. And you had to turn the valve so the steam was at a certain level to keep all of the stuff flowing or something. But his idea was
You had a college education.
I had a college background.
You were ready for this.
The valves. And he was a very interesting chap. And during the day was very long, believe me. We had to be there at 4 a.m. for that. And actually, we got up at 3:30 to get over there at 4 a.m. And along in mid-morning, when all of the troops had been fed breakfast and they were just starting to get ready for lunch, I found myself looking into the cool room, which was a huge room where they kept various cool things like vegetables, and they also kept the milk and juices. And I happened to be in there since the valves didn't need tending, and I saw a small carton of chocolate milk. And I thought, that would be nice right about now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I picked it up, shook it, opened it, and was glugging it down. And a spoon about 3 feet long flew past my head. The sergeant had come in and found me drinking the chocolate milk, and the spoon was his swagger stick, his symbol of authority, and he threw it. I'm glad it missed me.
Yes.
And he chased me the hell out and said, all right, don't do that again, et cetera, et cetera. So that was an interesting experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, each day we would be up, we would go out to the quadrangle, they would take the roll and so forth. And I was in M Company of the 60th Infantry Regiment of the 9th Division. And after we did the small arms and the automatic weapons and so on, we had to pull guard duty. And guard duty, you would have a guard mount, and your name would be called the night before and put on a roster, and you would know the next day you would have to be on guard duty. And in order to go on guard duty, you had to be really spiffy. Your boots had to be perfect and so forth and so on.
Where would you have been posted? Was there a
on
particular...
various
okay
on various what would I call them? Various buildings on various barbed wire enclosed fenced off areas that had vehicles in them.
Okay.
It was more of a drill, a routine to get you used to the idea that you are on guard, you take orders,
mm-hmm.
and this is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to remember the general orders. There were 11 general orders, as I remember. You know, I'll take charge of this post and not do something bad or something, and I will look to the left and right, and I will salute, and all of this kind of. You had to memorize those. So the guard mount came, and the person who was picked as the outstanding member of that guard mount became the colonel's orderly, which meant you didn't have to go out and march around in the middle of the night. You sat in the orderly room in case the colonel needed you.
This is incentive.
Which, of course, he would not need.
Right,
you.
Right.
And it meant that you kept warm. So on the first guard mount, I was selected. And I thought, gee, this is really neat. Now, one of the advantages I have, I just spent 2 years as a midshipman, and I could polish boots, and I could snap a salute, and I could memorize like you wouldn't believe. And so I got that, and it was wonderful. Well, the next guard mount, and we came up about every 3 weeks, as I remember, for guard. Next guard mount, I won it again. The next guard mount, we were down to two. It was me and another guy. And they asked us every question you could imagine, and I could answer it, and so could he. They asked to see our dog tags because some people didn't like to wear them, but we each had dog tags on.
Mm.
They looked at our rifles again, and my brother had shown me all kinds of things about the Garand rifle when he came home, and so I was very comfortable with it and had been in a drill team with the Garand, so I was very good at it. And so was the other guy. So finally, they had to make the choice, and the officer of the day said, take off your right boot. And both of us reached down, unlaced our boot, and took it off. And I was standing there in OD issue sock, and the other guy had a white athletic sock on.
Mm.
And that's not part of the uniform.
Mm.
So I became the general's orderly. And when you did it three times, and they told me it was rarely ever done,
mm-hmm.
you got a three-day pass from the colonel. Hot dog, I was going to get a three-day pass. So I went into the orderly room to report to the captain that I had just been told I was the colonel's orderly, and it was the third time, and three-day pass, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And when I walked in, First Sergeant was sitting there, and this lieutenant, whom I will never forget because I thought, I want to be like that guy. He was sharp. And I found out that he had flunked out of West Point and gone to OCS. Now, there's a story, but he was the perfect model of the lieutenant. Every crease was sharp as a knife. He was sharp as a tack, and very eloquent compared to the sergeants and so forth. And so when I made the announcement to the sergeant that I had just won the colonel's orderly again, he decided to have a little exam of his own. Now, the captain is sitting in his office, and he's looking out at this tableau of me standing at attention in front of the first sergeant's desk with the lieutenant on the side mm-hmm. of me, asking me questions. And finally, he got to the question, who's the Chief of Staff of the United States Army? And at that moment, I had one of those horrendous blocks. It just blocked my mind. And I didn't do anything other than go, And he said, I'll give you a hint. Do you drink? And I said, yes, sir, because I thought that was
the correct answer.
Thing to say.
Right.
And he said, what do you drink with orange juice in it? And I said, gin, sir. And the captain burst out laughing. I thought he was going to fall off his chair because the chief of staff was J. Lawton Collins.
Right.
And I was supposed to think of a Tom Collins.
right.
And I said, "Gin, sir." And it made the lieutenant feel foolish. The captain laughed at him, and it was an interesting, interesting time. But anyhow, my OCS appointment came in May, the end of May. I had to be there the 1st of June, roughly.
No, this is after AIT.
Right, this is after Advanced Individual Training.
And did
so
you...
I still had a month, so they kept me there as a cadre. Mm-hmm. And instead of being a trainee, I got to wear a shiny red helmet and pull on an armband with sergeant stripes on it so I could be an acting cadre. And I would march the troops out, and I would set them up in the stands before the instructor would come out and give a lecture. So I spent a month marching troops back and forth and having a much nicer life than actually being in advanced infantry training. And that lasted for a month. And then and here's another thing that I always found interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The OCS board, we had to meet the board. And the OCS board was going to determine which OCS you would go to. Because you could go to infantry, which most people went to, or you could go to artillery, or you could go to armor. So the OCS board was composed of a colonel and about four or five other officers of various ranks, with the secretary being a major. And I went into the OCS board and snappily saluted and said, "Sir, Private Shepherd reports to the president of the board." And he said, "Be at ease, Private. Well, let's see," he said, "tell me, where are you from?" And I said, "Kearney, New Jersey, sir." And he said, "My God, that's my hometown." He said, "How did the football team do this year against Nutley?" I said, "I'm not sure, sir, but I think we won."
Good answer.
And after that, the questions were not only softball, but actually, which OCS do you want to go to? And I said, "I want to go to artillery." Now, I said artillery because my brother told me that lieutenants in infantry that he knew in the Second World War were generally dead in the first day or two because they came up from OCS and they didn't know doodly,
mm-hmm.
and they got dead. And he said, "If you go to infantry OCS, I'll kill you myself." And I thought, well, maybe artillery is it. And I said, "I want to go to artillery." And he asked me why. And I told him because I had studied naval gunnery, which I had as a midshipman, for 2 years. And I was sure that there must be some overlap between naval gunnery and artillery. And I would be a natural for the artillery. And he said, "Thank you. That's all." I saluted and walked out. And the major secretary came out after me and grabbed a hold of me, and he said, "Well, you made it." That's how I went to OCS.
Did you ever think back about the guy from CIC and what you had been told?
Yes.
About that as a possibility?
Yes, I did. But by that time, I had been in the Army longer,
mm-hmm.
and I found out, as I mentioned earlier, that the CIC was not a branch of the Army.
Right, not like armor or artillery.
Right. I also found that they hadn't exactly told that to me, but you had to serve, when you went to an OCS, you then had to serve at least 2 years in that combat arm. You couldn't go to OCS as an artilleryman and then go to the intelligence corps or go to the finance corps.
Uh-huh.
You had to do your 2 years in the combat arm. So that idea of the CIC for the time went out the window.
It was receding anyway.
It was receding. Mm-hmm. But later on I'll tell you how I actually did get into intelligence and things have changed dramatically.
Well, let me ask a kind of a timeline question.
Yeah.
While you were at Fort Dix, were you paying much attention to events in Korea?
We all were. As a matter of fact, that was one of the things that the NCOs just stressed over and over. They kept telling us, "You better learn this. It may save your life. You're going to Korea. You better learn this. It'll save your life. You're going to Korea." They said it so often, we became inured to it after a while, but nonetheless, they stressed that there's a war on, it's in Korea, you're going, you better know how to use that rifle or that machine gun or that gas mask or how to clean your mess kit or how to read a map. You better know that if you want to stay alive. So indeed, it was on everybody's mind at the time.
And they were in a way keeping it real, it sounds
right.
like.
And most of them had come back from the Korean War.
Is that right?
Yeah.
In what way did you find that out? Because they told you directly or...
Some told us directly and some told us about others. For instance, the first sergeant that I had mentioned that I went in and reported to,
yes.
His name was Sergeant Holt, and his right thumb drooped uncontrolled. He couldn't control his right thumb as well as normal, and when he saluted, his right thumb hung down. Well, I don't know why I remember that, but I do.
Mm-hmm.
But I know why I remember him, because one day I saw my name on a fatigue detail. I was going to have to run, go behind the garbage truck. You kind of trotted behind the garbage truck at Fort Dix, and you picked up these garbage cans and threw them in and so forth. And I had been reading about OCS and the regulations and so on, and there was a regulation that said officer candidates will not, and then there was a list, break ground, do fatigue details in these areas, and it listed the number of things you weren't going to do because you were going to be an officer,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want to start you out like that. So my name was on this list to run behind the garbage truck, and I decided I better let Sergeant Holt know that, and I marched in and asked permission to see Sergeant Holt, and I had the temerity to tell him about the Army order that said candidates could not, and he literally ran around his desk and grabbed me. He didn't want any, I don't know what the epithet would be, but he didn't want anyone like me telling him what name he could put on a roster, and I found myself running behind a garbage truck for a very long couple of days. And Sergeant Holt was a Second World War veteran,
mm-hmm.
He was a regular Army guy and so forth, and he was ancient. He must have been 45 or 47 or something like that, and he was a real old-time soldier. And a number of the NCOs talked about him and, his service and so on, and they talked about each other, and did you know that so-and-so had been in this place and chosen and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a pretty good understanding that they were veterans, they knew the drill.
And they had been there, in a way.
And they had been there, mm-hmm. and even though we found them cantankerous and sometimes downright mean,
mm-hmm.
They were, quote, doing it for our own good because this may save your life when you go to Korea. That was the thing. They showed us how to light off a heater for the mess line. There was a heater that you put into a garbage can, which would be filled with water, and you lit the stove, this heater,
mm-hmm.
and it would eventually boil the water. So when you finished your meal, you walked by and you slushed it around in there, and they taught us how to light it off. And it actually was, it could be a little dangerous thing because one of us tried to light it off and looked down the pipe as he lit it, and it went poosh, and it took his eyebrows and burned them. And little things like that, the sergeants knew how to help us out so we wouldn't do things like that again. It was quite a time. It was one of the coldest winters I had spent in my life, was in a pup tent for two people in Fort Dix in a January snowstorm in New Jersey. I realized those soldiers who were at Valley Forge fighting the revolution,
mm-hmm.
they must have had a difficult time because we had really good equipment, and we were freezing to death out there. So
And did you hear stories about, for example, the fall of 1950, the autumn of 1950 in Korea, and equally stories about the cold and how important it was to be able to protect yourself?
Right, and protect our feet,
yeah.
Frostbite. We had to, they told us that we had to look at each other's feet. It wasn't good enough to look at your own. Someone else had to look at them because you couldn't generally make the decision that you were getting trench foot or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they stressed the hygiene of the mess gear and so forth.
All that basic stuff.
Right. And, you
know,
I think it was necessary, actually. In that time, there were a lot of people in my situation then, in basic training and so forth, that had come from the hills of some of the southern states, and they were literally ignorant of some of the niceties of staying clean and brushing teeth and things like that. They literally had to be taught those kinds of things.
Some of the basics.
Yes, some of the basics. The, mm-hmm. the number of people with bad teeth, for instance, at 19 or 20 from some of those areas of the country, I found it appalling, but that's the way it was.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting distinction, one that people now and probably in the future will, you know, find kind of hard to imagine. Americans.
Exactly.
But as you say, I mean, a number of these folks would be coming from completely different backgrounds than your own.
That's right.
Now,
and in the scientific and professional platoon, we were of a kind mostly,
mm-hmm.
But when we interacted with in these training exercises and in the classrooms and so on, we would interact with other people that weren't in scientific and professional, and that's when we would realize, my God, there is a different culture out there that just doesn't really equate to what we know. We were learning a great deal about the differences in the young men of our time at that time.
Tom, what kind of differences did you see aside from the hygienic ones or issues around accent? I mean, were there actual cultural differences that you remember?
Well, for instance, the music that they listened to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, country music, I never heard that until I got into the Army and into barracks and walking through quadrangles and companies, and I'd never heard that cowboy kind of music. Their accents were, we found, thick, almost difficult to understand. The colloquialisms that they used
mm-hmm.
were foreign to us. Would you carry me to the PX? That didn't mean get on your back and you walk them up. That meant if you're going to the PX, would you give them a ride?
Right.
Little things. And what they ate, the things they had. Grits was a new phenomenon to me. I'd never heard of grits until I got into the Army. And so on.
Were there any racial differences, and did that have any? Were there tensions around that?
Not a bit.
No tension.
Not a bit. There,
interesting.
There were no, in my platoon, there were no blacks,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't see many in the company, M Company, and occasionally an NCO would be black, but. No, I was not up in Fort Dix, New Jersey in 1951.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware of a racial divide at all.
When you got your orders for OCS. What were they going? Where were they going to take you?
I would go out to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and it was my first airline flight.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was 1950, and they were still propeller-driven. 1951, sorry, and they were still propeller-driven planes. And I landed in Oklahoma City and had to take a bus. The Army didn't meet you. You were supposed to be there for OCS. So I took a bus from Oklahoma City to Lawton, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. which was the town outside of the gates. And the bus got me there about 4:30 in the morning. And I found that there was another bus that went out to the base, and this one was provided by the Army. And I took that out there, and I actually got there so early, Reveille had not sounded. And so I was dropped off in the OCS area on Fort Sill. The first person I talked to was a fire watch guy, and that was a GI whose job it was during the night to walk around through the barrack areas and keep his eye out to see that no fires had broken out or anything like that. And I met him. He was an OCS candidate. And I of course, went through, gee, what's it like? What's the hard part? What's the good part? Mm-hmm. And so forth. And then Reveille sounded, and it exploded into action there, believe me. And I reported in and got assigned to my platoon and so forth. And the first thing they did was give me the OCS patches and tell them, they told me, get them sewn on. And I was the guy who sewed them on. I didn't know where a tailor shop was or anything, and so I sewed on the patches on the sleeves.
You did it yourself?
Yeah, uh-huh. I did it myself.
Did you have any skill in that area, or were you picking it up as you went?
I knew that it had better damn well be neat. That's all I knew. And so I was very careful and stuck myself a number of times, but I got them on. As soon as I could, later I got everything taken over to the tailor shop, because you really had to be spiffed up.
It had to be done right.
Make it through OCS and so on. And
now, what time of year was it that you arrived there?
I arrived around the 1st of June. Because I graduated for November, so June, July, August, September, October, November. It was probably 1st of May or early part of May that I arrived.
So it was getting warm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I arrived with a winter uniform, and they had just changed over to khakis, which really made it hard because I didn't have all the khakis I would need, and the ones I had were in a duffel bag. And if you've ever carried anything in a duffel bag, you know it doesn't come out looking like OCS tailored material. And so for the first couple of days, it was really scary trying to get everything done and find the rules and all of that kind of stuff. And they made it particularly hard. They were not interested in making you feel that this was going to be a piece of cake and you were going to walk through it. They had the idea that they were going to drop a lot of you out. And
so,
if I remember correctly, and don't hold me exactly to these numbers, but about 195 of us started in my class and 55 of us graduated.
So the attrition was
heavy.
This was partly by design,
lack of
walkthrough.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Once we got underway, you could see the design was very evident in such mind-bending things as destroying all of the careful work you had done. You had a bunk, and you had behind you, you had a little shelf, and in front of the bunk you had your footlockers. And your footlocker had to be such that they could open it at any time, and everything would be measured perfectly apart from one another and shined and so forth, and your boot soles would be shined and the back of your belt buckle would be shined and your books would be lined up in a certain way. And while you were gone, the cadre would come in and just throw everything on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Some sometimes they would throw it on the floor in a pile, so that trying to find your boots or trying to find your books was an onerous task because there were just like 30 pairs in a heap kind of a thing. And they would often give you 3 minutes to fix things and then report outside. And some of them were impossible to do, and that was part of the deal, too. You could not possibly do everything. You just could not do it. And so were you going to break down because you didn't get it done? And some people did. Some people quit in the first week. They simply walked in and said, I don't want to do this. And they immediately got their orders, and they left for Korea.
Did you understand all of this? I mean, with the clarity that obviously you have now, and
having been a midshipman for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
And having spent the first year making square corners and lighting cigarettes for people, and
rowing in the middle of the
double
night,
time and rowing to China,
right?
And diving under the bunks with a rifle in your arm, and so I knew exactly what it was like, and I had learned about silent contempt,
right.
And I had learned how to make that disappear happily.
Mm-hmm.
Not successful all the time, but mostly all of the time. And so, yes, I was well prepared for the harassment part of it.
I just wonder whether other guys kind of figured out that you had it figured out and asked you, yo, exactly. I mean,
yeah.
Would they come to you for advice because they could see that you were coping?
Actually, we had some people in my class who were 26, 27 years old who had spent 4 years as an NCO in the Army. And they were the ones that were sort of looked to because, you know, we looked upon, you know, they were, quote, lifers.
Yes.
They had been NCOs. Some of them had ribbons on their shirt. And so you kind of looked to them, even though not necessarily did they know some of the things because they had spent 4 years in regular line units as an NCO. And after OCS, all that harassment has got to go. I mean, that doesn't function in the regular Army, this niggling, throw your boots on the floor kind of stuff just is not real life.
Right, exactly.
And so those NCOs did not always know some of the psychology that was being used against them. But they were sort of the bulwarks. They were the older guys. They had been NCOs. They had 3 ribbons on their pocket or something. And that's where you gravitated. Many of the guys gravitated to them and said, what should I do here? What should I do there?
Do you remember some of the guys who didn't finish that you thought maybe would? Do you remember any instances of individuals leaving and the circumstances? It might be, as an illustration, interesting.
Well, you know, I have the OCS graduation book right over there on that desk right there. I can remember more vividly a couple of guys that we thought weren't going to make it.
Okay.
Who did make it.
Interesting. Okay.
One of them just emanated a sort of pick on me kind of an aura. The kind that a person, a bully in authority, just can sniff out, and they're gravitated towards them.
They would latch onto this person.
They would latch on.
Uh-huh.
They would say such things as, well, they generally will say, this fellow, and I don't want to mention his name.
That's fine.
But candidate blank is standing at attention, and two of the Redbirds. Now, a Redbird is an OCA candidate who is in his last month, and he is allowed to wear red tabs at his shoulders, which indicates to you you're supposed to salute him, and he's supposed to be treated like an officer. See, part of the process of getting him used to getting salutes and so forth.
Transitioning.
But they were the upper class of the OCS. And so here is Private Blank with an upperclassman on each side of him. And this is early on. And one of them has looked at his belt buckle and pulled it out enough so he could turn it over to look at the back. And he determined that the back was not polished enough. Now, it was probably polished as much as mine, but Private Blank just had that kick me kind of feeling about him. So one would say something like, well, Private Blank, are you growing penicillin on this belt buckle? And, of course, Private Blank would be scared and not know what is that supposed to mean. And he would have to answer, Sir, Candidate Blank, no, sir. And then the other Redbird on the other side would shout in his ear, well, it's moldy. Now, do you get that? Are you growing penicillin on your belt buckle? No, no, no. Well, it's moldy. And this would reverberate through the quadrangle. And little things like that would go on all the time. For a Redbird to get your attention and tell you to approach him, he would holler, drive over here, candidate. That was sort of artillery talk, because we had prime movers that moved the heavy artillery pieces and drive over here, candidate. So Private Blank would hear that drive over here, candidate, more often than a typical candidate. Some of the candidates tried to become invisible, and for many that worked. Just don't raise your head, kind of. And others tried to become so outstandingly good that they would be liked. And then there was the Private Blanks who just said, kick me. And occasionally a Private Blank would make it all the way through, and we would be stunned. Because most of them, after being harassed on a daily basis for 5 months and had your gear thrown and dirtied and so forth, they would pretty much give up. And that's what they were looking for.
And the giving up resulted in?
Immediate set of orders to the holding company, the REPL depot, the replacement company, replacement depot, and generally orders to Korea as a private.
And everyone was pretty much aware of that, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Here's the story. At the end, 5 months and 2 weeks, two of the candidates got orders to Korea, just like most of us did. But they had been in Korea as enlisted men, and they understood that because they had been in Korea as enlisted men, they would not get orders to Korea. They would get stateside orders or orders to Europe. And both of them marched up to the orderly room to say, hey, I was promised blah, 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 blah. They did not get their commissions. They were dropped from OCS and went to the replacement company at their old rank, which was, I think, buck sergeant.
For having questioned
their orders. Officers do not question their orders. And that was the lesson.
Wow.
So, and I remembered it just right now, so that must have been a good lesson.
Yeah, it's
and
stuck
boy, that went through the company like wildfire.
I'll bet, yeah.
You know, the so-and-so went up and questioned their orders, and boom, they're out. So we knew that even at the last minute, you didn't have it made if you did something that was not officer-like. And quite frankly, I think Fort Sill did a pretty damn good job of turning people out. I really do.
What about your learning the arts of artillery?
Gunnery was a 12-week course.
Mm-hmm.
We spent approximately 500 hours in gunnery classrooms. A lot of the classrooms were little tiny shed-like things out on firing ranges where we had opportunities to actually fire on targets, fire live artillery on targets. So there was a very practical aspect to that, to be a forward observer. But the difficult part was you had to be able to do a basic gunnery problem. And I would say there was a... You had to have an understanding of trigonometry. and you had to have a little understanding of physics. Mm-hmm. You had to know what the Coriolis effect was. You had to know what super elevation was. But they taught it so well in the classes that, generally speaking, a typical 110 AGCT score individual could go through it. And the fourth week, see, gunnery was 8 weeks long for the 500 hours. The fourth week was known as Bloody Four because in Bloody Four, you had this horrendous big examination in gunnery. And that's when people flunked out of OCS at Bloody Four because they could not do the gunnery problem. And the last thing you would want is somebody in the fire direction center firing 105 howitzers out in your direction and not being able to do the gunnery problem, because it would mean the rounds would land anywhere and you couldn't afford that. So Bloody Four was the fourth week of gunnery and out you went. And the total hours was about 500 hours of gunnery. And that was the key for the artillery OCS. You had to be able to pass the Bloody Four examination.
And you mentioned that there was a good deal of, you know, complex math involved, and that the teaching was good.
Yes. Not complex per se. You could do it pretty
probably for me close. It would be complicated, but
you could do it. Believe me, you weren't doing regressions or anything like that. You just had to have an understanding of the trigonometry of the gunnery problem. And I figured if I could do it, most anybody could do it.
But was there some intuitive level that if you could grasp it, you could work the numbers out? I mean, is that how it felt to you?
It was the kind of thing, if you could memorize the steps, it's like navigation. Mm-hmm. Navigating a boat, if you can memorize the steps and even use the mnemonics, does every virgin live in Boston or something
right.
like that, would tell you, oh, first you take the deviation, then you take, if you could just grasp that and then plug in numbers and check them, you generally were okay.
But still, this was a breaking point for a lot of people.
It was a big breaking point, yes.
Wow. Did you have any difficulty?
I probably had more worry than difficulty. Mm-hmm. I wanted this so badly that I wasn't going to flunk it. And
yeah, it sounds like you're pretty motivated.
By God, I worked at it. I worked at it and worked at it, and anyone I thought was really good at it, I would sit and ask them, check me, see what I've done, what is this, what is that. I worked at it hard.
So had you gotten over the part about it being difficult to ask for help or it being some kind of sign of weakness for asking for
yes.
for assistance?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Right.
It really does.
As an aside, I must tell you, for my 34 years of college teaching, mm-hmm. I made it a point right up front to let the students know. The A students generally end up sitting in the first two rows of the class. Why is that? Because they interact with the professor more. And if you come to my office and ask for help, you'll get it. Don't worry about who I am. Let's worry about getting you an education. And a lot of them had never heard. See, I taught them when they were juniors and seniors, and then in graduate school. And a lot of them had never heard that.
I'm sure that's right.
College.
So. I completely believe that. Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask what happened at the end of OCS. I suppose there was a celebration of some kind.
There was a hell of a celebration. One of the things that I remember vividly, just before we graduated, we had a long weekend kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my friends there was a graduate of Brown University, and he invited me to go back home with him. There was a big football game, Harvard and Brown, and his fraternity was having a big hoop-de-doo. And I take it back, we had just gotten our bars. We had just graduated. And so he invited me to the Brown-Harvard game, and we went back, and there we were. In those days, we wore pinks and greens, which, that makes sense to you, does it not? That's,
in terms of the uniform?
Yeah,
yes.
The uniform was the taupe trousers, which we call pinks, and the jacket we call greens, and it was actually sort of a Loden color jacket that you saw in the Second World War. It had a belt. It wasn't these horrible green uniforms that we
wear now. You don't like them, huh?
No, they're terrible. But we wore pinks and greens, and we had a wonderful time on the Brown campus, being brand new lieutenants and going to the fraternity parties and the football games, and that was absolutely wonderful. And we got there by driving all the way right straight through the night from Lawton, Oklahoma.
That's a good
coast.
That's a good long drive.
Yeah, there were four of us in the car, and we rotated the whole way through. And then when we got to New York, we dropped off two guys, and the two of us went up to Brown and had a wonderful time. It was a wonderful party. Everybody was happy, and as I say, we started with about 195. 55 graduated.
Now, people might find it interesting, or at least intriguing, that you were in uniform on university campus.
Right.
On
right.
football weekend.
And being lionized.
Right.
Right.
Can I explain that? Yeah.
Those were different times. That's all I can tell you. Those were different times.
Was that still, do you think, because of the kind of in the public consciousness, a layover from World War II?
Absolutely.
Okay, rather than being associated in any way with Korea.
Absolutely. I would say that it was the aftermath of all of the good feelings of World War II. As I said, remember, we were in pinks and greens.
Right.
We looked like the people they saw in the movies,
when
they were
yeah.
growing up.
Yeah.
We looked like Eisenhower looked and Patton looked. Those were the uniforms. The draft, by that time, the draft had finally swung around so that there were deferments for people in college. And I think that had a little bit to do with lessening the possibility of tension with certain classes of people because, we can stay in college and we don't have to face that. In the meantime, this is a war we're in, and these guys remind us of our older brothers and stuff like that. Yeah.
Was there also a sense that Korea was... And I just wonder whether you have an observation about this, either as you remember it or looking back, that Korea was a good war? World War II?
The term good war is foreign to me, actually.
Okay.
That's a modern day.
Yes.
We're wrestling with good wars now, and we weren't wrestling that way that I was aware of as a 21-year-old lieutenant.
How about
I graduated on 4 November 1952, so I was a 22-year-old lieutenant.
Mm-hmm. How about a just war?
Yeah. Let's say it was a war that we felt was keeping those damn communists from doing something that we didn't want them to do. Because if we didn't do that, then we were liable to lose the rest of Asia. Because if they saw we were weak and couldn't protect the people we said we were going to help, then the other countries would say, well, we want to be on the winning side, and the U.S. ain't going to be the winner.
Right. Yeah. Were you paying much attention to...
politics?
Public politics, yeah. Say McCarthy and those power struggles.
I have paid so much attention to it for the last 34 years. I don't know if I was paying attention to it 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I was aware of it. And at the beginning, I was enthralled that we had found this list with the names of communists
mm-hmm.
on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from my reading now, reading the Navona papers, I believe.
Verona. Mm-hmm.
Verona.
Mm-hmm.
That indeed we were pretty heavily infiltrated in a number of areas. Nonetheless, McCarthy made a terrible botch of it, and his alcoholism didn't help him, and then his dogmatism. He didn't play the game. He just was brute force, and then I think the alcohol just dulled all of his senses, and didn't he die of alcoholism?
I think a heart attack and resulting from that or something, yeah. He didn't have a lot of finesse. I think that's probably clear.
I can wrap up OCS mm-hmm. for you by saying that OCS graduated something like from its inception in the Second World War, it graduated, the artillery OCS graduated about 56,000 people. I could actually look it up and give you the right number, but it's about 56,000. And I was inducted to the OCS Hall of Fame, in Fort Sill, and I was number 700 of the inductees, and it was in May of 1995. So they have a Hall of Fame at Fort Sill
mm-hmm.
for OCS, and I was lucky enough to make it. And there are 700 of us at last count in there out of the 56,000.
Do you know what the process was for that?
Yes. Your name has to be forwarded, put up
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
before some board, and then they have to look at your military record, and they look at your educational record, and they look at your community record. And it's sort of, it's just done. If you've made general officer from OCS, you're going to make it. For instance, the highest ranker in the Hall of Fame is General Shelley Keshvili, who was OCS probably 55, 56, something like that. And as you may remember, ended up as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs under Bill, what's his name, Clinton.
That would be right, yeah.
So Shelley Keshvili is mm-hmm. in the Hall of Fame. And one fellow from my class stayed in for the full 30, and he was brigadier, so he's in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Some people who got the Medal of Honor obviously were right in the Hall of Fame, and people who made full colonel and were regular Army generally were invited into the Hall of Fame, because for an OCSer, that's
pretty good,
quite remarkable, because most of them only stay for their tour, and they're out when they're captains and so on. And I was regular Army, and I was put up for it because I had performed these workshops for the Department of the Army for, I guess, about 24 years. And I had something like 12,000 attendees over the 24 years in my programs for the Army, and that, with the fact that I was a regular and I had a doctorate, and they put all that together and they said, okay, we're going to induct you. So I flew out for the ceremony because it was very nice. I wanted to see Snow Hall again at mm-hmm. Fort Sill and all that kind of thing. So that kind of wraps up OCS.
Okay, well, let's take a break there, Tom.